So, Sonny, since your brother is a former Division One baseball
Former.
player, yeah, former. We talked about this. Did you care at all about the Texas Rangers winning the World Series?
Oh, Tim, I'm sorry. I didn't. I don't. I
Did
didn't
you even know
watch
that?
it. No,
Am I breaking?
actually, I know. And I just told Hogan, like, oh, I like baseball. Send me baseball videos like you send to Tim. And I don't
He
even
does.
know
He
the
sends me baseball videos all the time.
Well, you like baseball.
I
And
do.
I went to
I
a
much
lot of
appreciate
Ranger
it.
games because my dad had season tickets when he was alive. My stepmother still lives in Dallas. I was in Dallas because I had a meeting with a very important person who shall remain nameless. And I went back to her house to spend the night before I came back to DC. And they had the game on. It was just over. And they were elated because we spent a lot of hours sweating profusely in the summer heat, watching the Rangers
Yeah,
play baseball and
Arlington Stadium.
not quite getting there. In fact, we went to the All-Star game when they just built the stadium in Arlington. Now they have a new one, but back then the other one was new, and we went to the All-Star game that year. So I have
And
some old
so
Ranger tie there.
63 years as a franchise, first world champ. So, I mean, I didn't care
Oh,
much
good
about it
for
because
them.
of who was playing, but so good for them.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have, I'm very excited about this next guest. It's a really fine professional journalist who I've known for a number of years. And Hogan, I know that you are familiar with her as well. And Sonny, you're going to have the first conversation I think that you've had with her. And I trust it will be very enjoyable and informative. And we might as well get started here because that's what we do. This is the Line Drive Podcast.
Speaking of world champions.
Speaking of, yes, that's a good intro, Hogan. Speaking of world champions, the great Selena Zito, whose many fans are legion across this country and others. Selena, thank you so much for being with us today. Welcome.
Oh my goodness, thanks for having me. I am fans of all three of yours, so we're all in good company tonight.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I've been knowing you since I worked for USDA, I think is when I first crossed paths, when I worked for Sunny in
Yes.
Purdue. So that would have been 2017-ish, I think, when we first talked. But let me read. This is your I want to tell people where they can find your stuff and a little bit more about you. This is your little bio on the Washington Examiner's website. All right. Let's how impressive does this sound? Selena Zito joined the Washington Examiner in 2016 as a Pittsburgh-based columnist and reporter and is also a columnist at the New York Post. She is the author of The Great Revolt. She previously wrote for The Atlantic and spent the last 11 years at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review as both a reporter and a columnist covering national politics. And here's I knew all that stuff. Here's something I did not know. Before that, she worked for the Pittsburgh Steelers and held staff positions for both Democratic and Republican elected officials in Pennsylvania. She has interviewed every president and vice president in the 21st century.
Gee.
In the 2016 election cycle, she interviewed 22 presidential candidates. I didn't know there were that many. I guess there were.
Wow.
Because
Wow.
23andMe, we used to joke about the Democrats and what's her face, Elizabeth Warren. 22 candidates, both Democrat and Republican, in 2016. That is astounding. How do you find time? Plus, you're a mother and grandmother as well. How do you fit it all in?
I don't know. If I think about it, I probably wouldn't be able to pull it off. I also write for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. So if people want to check out my work, I always tell them to go to selenazito.com. I've also done a couple stories for the Free Press as well. But my day job, my daily reporting is at the Washington Examiner. And I don't fly, not because I'm afraid to. I actually fall asleep as soon as I get in the plane. But in terms of as being a reporter, I don't fly to go to where I'm looking to see what's going on. I always drive. And I don't even take the interstate. I only take back roads. And there's a reason for that. I can understand where you can see when you're going to a place or you're trying to understand what's happening. Very important not to just go to a city, right? To understand what's happening in a region because culture impacts people's votes. But also, if something good is happening in a region or bad, you have to drive around the different counties and the different towns and the neighborhoods. So that's why I understood what was going to happen in 2016. Wasn't that I was for or against Trump. It's just that it was so evident everywhere I went and in the interviews and in places where people, conventional wisdom would tell you, this isn't a place that would traditionally vote for a Republican. But this is also something I understood in 2006. I knew the Republicans were going to lose the House that year. And in 2010, I knew the Democrats were going to lose the House that year as well. It's just that I think people have zeroed in on the understanding Trump because Trump was so outside of the norm in American politics.
You were one of, I think, the only one who was visible in knowing and predicting that the Trump thing, the only one I'm actually even aware of, knowing that the Trump victory was coming in 2016. So I definitely want to hear about your take on what's going on in this election cycle and other news around this country and the world. But there was news in the last few days about the death of Matthew Perry. And I want to bring that up. And it's a little bit of an unusual topic for this podcast. We usually talk about politics and stuff. But way back when, in your journalistic life, you had a personal experience with Matthew Perry. And I thought it sounded pretty interesting just from what I read about it on Twitter. What, tell us about that interaction that you had with him.
I did. And it actually wasn't when I was a journalist. Pittsburgh Penguins used to do this charity event, and they would have a celebrity hockey match, right? And they would have celebrities playing the regular hockey players. And at that time, for the Penguins, that was Mario Lemieux, Jaromir Jagr, right? That was like the real hot years of the Penguins. And Matthew Perry was one of the hockey players, and I had volunteered. I had no idea who I was going to be driving or any around or anything, but I had volunteered to drive whoever was playing around to the different events that they had to do to help raise money. It was for cancer. Matthew Perry just happened to be sitting in the front seat with me, and we spent well over an hour. And I'm like, you know, I'm in my mom van. and with like socks, smelly soccer socks and cleats and everything tucked down in the back. You know who else was there? The guy that played the Clarence for the E Street Band with Bruce.
Oh, Clarence Clemens.
He was in my car. And
the big man is what Bruce used to call him.
And so was Flea.
Are you kidding?
Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Who was not in the car?
I was just a mom then. So I was like not all into all that. So I was like driving around, you know, like not overwhelmed by the idea that there were celebrities in my old blue minivan. It was just like I was helping people out. But Perry and I, we probably talked for well over an hour. He was so funny and so sweet. He couldn't have been more. I think he said he was 24 at the time.
So he was on Friends, but
Friends was probably maybe into his fourth or fifth episode. So it was just starting to become this cultural phenomenon. So, you know, it was just before his life altered in a very major way.
Yeah. So the last time he was ever in a minivan.
It sounds like the beginning of a joke. So Flea, Clarence Clemens, and Matthew Perry get into a minivan with Selena Zito.
Yes,
I'm like favorite a Forrest Gump of journalist.
That's amazing.
That is remarkable. You said he was funny. Did he? You know, it's kind of a dry sense of humor on the show. Is that just a character?
That was him. Okay. He was very self-deprecating, but he saw in very ordinary things and an extraordinary way of making light of them.
Yeah.
That's the best way I can put it. And I can't remember what he said. I just can remember like cracking up the entire time we're driving around.
Yeah.
What an amazing story. That's probably one that you don't think of. And then the other day when you see the news that he died, you think, oh my gosh, I actually spent a long time with him. Fascinating. So let's get into that. It's a sad story, and we appreciate you relating your personal experience. I never met the guy, but he seemed like, you know, everybody has a friend who kind of acts like Chandler Bing. And
my dad
always, so I sort of felt like I knew Matthew Perry just because I knew so many guys who acted like that. You know,
he was my favorite character on the show by far. Yeah. Chandler was my favorite.
Any more funny?
right. That's good stuff. So let's talk about what's going on in the world. And it's interesting that you say that you don't fly, because I found this quote on your website, SelenaZito.com, I suppose it is. And it's a quote from you. And it says, in my estimation, there is no patch of geography in this country that is the quote middle of nowhere. This is America. Everywhere is the middle of somewhere. And that's really a fascinating way to look at that. So can you talk about how that's your philosophy, and how does that inform your reporting, and what's it tell you about what's going on out there right now?
You know, with modern culture throws out a lot of platitudes about diversity and inclusion, and it often it never pays attention to it. Those words are never applied to the people that live in what I call the middle somewhere, right? The parts of the country that aren't heavily populated, that you know, aren't the centers of commerce or culture in a geographic area, but nonetheless are a very important fabric of our country. And these are the people after Trump won that scholars said, what's wrong with these people? Who are they? And then they came out like an expedition, you know, like sort of a safari looking for them. There's right. some, you know, we're a very interesting country, and the people that I cover don't want that attention per se, but they do want respect, and their voices in an election in the middle of Pennsylvania are much more important than whatever someone's opinion is in New York or Washington, D.C., because Pennsylvania will decide a presidential race. Pennsylvania will decide a majority in the U.S. Senate, or tilt the congressional majority in one direction or another, and New York City and Washington, D.C. will not.
Yeah.
I write about this a lot, the problem with my profession, but also other large professions, like corporations, institutions, government, sports, all of these entities and technology, all these entities are located in large, sort of the super zip codes of the country, right? The concentrations of wealth and power, like New York and Washington, D.C. And so a lot of times, let's just focus on my profession, there is a perceived bias from people that live in the middle of the country on how their lives are reported. Well, there is. It's not that these reporters, you know, are mean, intentionally mean. It's just that they don't know anyone that live in those zip codes in the middle of somewhere, right? They haven't had the same cultural experiences. So when they zip in and zip out, they're very foreign to them. They don't understand them. And so that, I don't know why I'm going on about that, but I can't remember.
No, I know what you're talking about. It's like when the New York Times airdrops somebody into the heartland somewhere, and it's like an anthropology, expedition.
And so I think there's, and I forget the original question at this point, because I just sort of ran.
Well, how does the idea about everywhere is the middle of somewhere?
Oh, so that's,
what are people missing about what's going on?
Well, they're missing a big chunk of the country that doesn't share the same worldview as New York and Washington, D.C. And so when elections surprise them, you know, in either direction, Democrat or Republican, you know, in 2006, you know, I can remember having a conversation with Melman. That's what his last name was.
The RNC chairman?
Ken Melman.
Yeah, he was the head of the RNC. And they had this thing called Voter Vault.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was way ahead of its time.
I remember Voter
and
Vault.
And he kept saying, well, we're, you know, I kept saying, you know, I think y'all are going to lose. And he kept saying, no, we have Voter Vault. All our voters are showing up. I said, well, yeah, they're showing up, but they're just not showing up for you.
Yeah, they're voting all right.
Yeah, they are. And they did. And the Democrats that year had wisely, Rahm Emanuel was brilliant.
It was that 2006?
Yeah, wisely. Yeah,
that's when Nancy Pelosi.
Democrats to run in places. And Rahm Emanuel, for whatever your feelings are about him, he understood place. He understood the importance of a elected official representing, being reflective of a district. And that's the same is true of in 2016 when Trump ran. People, you know, you have to understand place. People didn't vote for Trump because of Trump. He didn't cause the conservative coalition to form. That started to form in 2006. He was the result of it.
Yeah.
That's another thing that people missed.
Yeah, I would argue he didn't murder politics. He was a corner. It was dead. He just showed up and said, look, this is all a disaster. People blame him like the world wasn't spinning. There was no mean politics before Donald Trump, which is obviously ridiculous. But I do think he weaponized the voices that Mike Huckabee started to really galvanize
Mike Huckabee,
in 2008, like Santorum did in 2016 or 2012.
Hogan is rattling off the list of all the candidates he's worked for.
Well, yeah. I saw a lot of this because I'm not from D.C. or New York. And so I've been around the country and I go to these small places and I talk to a lot of different people. And I often, in speeches I give, I will sometimes use a line that is some version of the mainstream media didn't get Donald Trump because they don't get you. They don't understand the problems you face every day, the struggles you face, the way you think about things. And as Tim said, when you parachute in a reporter, and I'm going to use that even in quotes, to one of these areas, sometimes what they uncover is just everyday life. But to them, it's like they're walking through a petting zoo and it's like something they've never seen before. People have have different opinions and they have different sayings and they care about different issues than they were told were important from the on high elites, as you pointed out, Selena. So I guess, as we move past 2016, past 2020, and head into 2024, are you looking or seeing one or two things that the media just miss and don't get, something that's bubbling under the surface? You can kind of give us a preview of what you expect to be a big driver of turnout.
Well, we're really in an odd holding pattern.
Yes.
I've usually been able to detect something moving one way or another. And I know the economy is impacting people. You see people retracting from spending. I just hear it in conversations with people. So the economy is part of that holding pattern. And that is stuck with Biden. But I also, what's happening in Israel?
Yeah.
Is really causing this unbelievable fracture within the Democratic Party that I don't think we quite understand the full implications of yet. However, I think that as we watch some of these Pennsylvania races, I think it'll give us an indication I think that working class whites and working class blacks are going to hold back, either not show up to vote and or vote Republican in these off-year elections because of the way they're impacted by the economy. And then you take suburban voters, in particular suburban Democrat voters, but also suburban Republican voters who were so turned off by Trump, they voted Democrat, are looking at these protests and rallies and these young people who have no sort of sense of history and sense of understanding of what they're doing. And they are rethinking how they're going to vote next week. I think we're going to get a lot of information from these off-year elections. I know I'm really paying attention to here in my home state in Pennsylvania for the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court race, but also in a couple local elections, in particular in Allegheny County, which is the county that surrounds Pittsburgh, where you have a member, she just announced it, she's not a member, a member of the Democratic Socialists of America running for the county executive seat. This is traditionally not a very ideologically held seat. And so it's interesting to see if the Republican is able to overcome her because of all the things that the DSA has done in support for the Hamas and Palestine movement.
Well, piggybacking off of Hogan's question a little bit, you know, you've had a very long, successful career as a reporter. You're one of the very few that actually report the truth without spin and without having your own bias in it. And I just wonder if you've seen throughout your career the corporate media get more and more corrupt. And what are your thoughts on the propaganda going on right now with Israel? What we see, do you think social media plays a role in the propaganda with all this sympathy towards Hamas right now, especially the younger generation? We see all these protests on college campuses in Durham today. I live in North Carolina, and there was a protest in the middle of a highway today in Durham.
Yeah.
So I mean, you have such a wonderful career. You have paid so close attention to the media throughout these years. I want to know, what are your thoughts on this propaganda? Do you think social media plays a role? What do you say?
Oh, sure. I think social media plus our education system plays a lot of blame for the reaction from young people about Palestine and Israel. It is, you know, when I was a kid, I was only 20 years removed from when Anne Frank died when I read her book.
Wow.
Okay, so that was a very, World War II, what happened in Germany, and the lessons from that were all around me. We learned that. Our uncles served in that war. My uncles liberated concentration camps. So I had a really, you know, I was able to touch history because it was right in front of me. The people that are teaching our young people today are distant from that history and are not educated by that history, and therefore they're not educating our young people. And I also think, look, young people spend all their time on TikTok, right?
So true.
Well, go on TikTok and you'll see 300,000 videos about pro Hamas and pro Palestine, and you see like 20,000 videos about Israel, pro Israel. It's not cool to be pro Israel. It's cool to be pro Hamas, and so that's
unbelievable.
That's really a large part of our problem in terms of our media. I just think it should all move to Columbus, Ohio. Like, it shouldn't be. People that are reporting on the middle of the country need to be reporting from where they're reporting, because they don't understand people. They don't know anybody that sits in a pew on Sunday.
So true.
They don't know anybody that owns a gun. They don't know anybody who knows how to use a gun, right? And so all these normalcies, these American traits, that are very normal outside of larger cities are considered abnormal. And that's our problem. That's our disconnect.
Who's the, Tim, who's the guy? It was a lady, I think. It was a reporter. And Selena, you probably know too. Who was the person who, when Nixon won, famously, it was a reporter who said, I don't know how Nixon won. I don't know anybody who voted for Nixon. And they're like a New York Times reporter. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. I Googled that the other day. That may be part urban legend. But
no,
yeah,
that's true.
No, New York Times reporter asked a woman in New York City what she thought about Nixon winning. That's how.
And I don't know anybody who wrote
old enough to remember that.
There you go.
So you said a couple things that are you went over a lot of different stuff. The TikTok stuff is what bothers me because, you know, when Congress gets worked up and they make, you know, fiery speeches on the floor of the House about TikTok and all that stuff, they're always talking about the Chinese because it's Chinese owned, but they're talking about it as though it's spyware. And I'm sure it is. And all the data that they're collecting because they have this on your phone. TikTok is on your phone. It's gathering up all your data. And certainly that's a threat. And I think that should be taken seriously. But the more grave threat long term is a lot more damaging, I think, than data. It's the propaganda element. Here you have the communist Chinese that has a method by which they can put their preferred message in front of tens of millions of Americans, including if our future generation that, you know, in 10 years is actually going to be running the country. And they can get them to believe whatever they want them to believe. And if today it's they're favoring Palestine over the Palestinians over Israel, you just described the effects of that. What's next? I mean, they can very easily turn an entire generation of Americans against America. By using that. I mean, has there ever been a threat like this before where really our biggest geopolitical adversary, China, has a communications method where they can communicate directly and influence the thinking of tens of millions of Americans one-on-one through this app that they have planned?
The next generation too.
Yeah, it's amazing. Amazing.
So, I mean, propaganda's been around forever.
Right.
You saw that in World War II, that was used by radio, right? However, it did not have the broad range impact that TikTok has on our young people. And I don't understand parents. I mean, maybe I'm just an old Italian grandma. But I mean, my kids didn't have cell phones until they were 18 and they could afford to pay for it. I didn't want them in front of a cell phone. Why? You know, you lose, as soon as you do that, you lose control. And as a parent, your job is to control, you know, not to let someone else take control of your child's brain. But, you know, a lot of this has to do with the parents today. Parenting is hard, and it's easier to parent them. You know, and so, you know, we have a lot of cultural this isn't just political, this isn't just propaganda. We have parents that for whatever reason have given up.
Well, it's so much easier just to hand them an iPad or a phone and say, okay, go. But like Tim, you and I were talking, or you tweeted about this, I think, the ads that they are putting on kids' YouTube.
Saturday morning, we're in the kitchen at home and we're watching videos on YouTube about this guy is a Lego building guy. So he does nothing but build. Sometimes he follows the kit and follows the instructions. Other times he's, you know, sort of freestyling. But it's a guy, it's a kid who builds Legos and he makes videos of this on YouTube. It's perfectly harmless. Unless it's election season and you get the TV ads every few minutes that pop into your video feed on YouTube. And it's from the Democrats talking about abortion. Wall to wall. We're trying to watch a video about Legos. With my five-year-old son, and now we have to watch this dumb 30-second ad about, of course, I scramble and change the channel, but why are you putting abortion ads in the middle of my Lego video? It's astounding.
Speaking of abortion, I've been down to Mississippi and Kentucky covering those governor's races.
Yes.
And I think, you know, I don't know if anybody's been paying attention to that race in Mississippi. It's Governor Tate Reeves, Republican, and Democrat Brandon Presley. And, you know, it's just numbers, right? Democrats never win Mississippi. However, they have dumped a ton of money into Mississippi.
Yep.
So I started thinking about this, like, why? Brandon Presley isn't even that great of a candidate. He's pro-life. So why is Planned Parenthood giving him millions of dollars, right? Brandon Presley is the Democrat and also the second cousin of Elvis Presley. So why do you think Mississippi, why are they trying so hard to at least force Reeves to spend a ton of money and possibly win? What has to be abortion? Because that's where the Dobbs ruling came out. And they want to punish Mississippi for the Dobbs. And the Democrats are just making money. Same in Kentucky. You know, Daniel Cameron, the Republican state attorney general, first Black attorney general in Kentucky, first statewide Black in Kentucky, first Republican attorney general in decades. He is running for governor, and he is such an outstanding candidate for the Republicans. He's aspirational. He is running on real conservative policies, in particular on education and fiscal responsibility, but also on crime. And Beshear, you know, I just think there is a big chance that people will wake up on Wednesday morning next week and the first Black governor of Kentucky is going to be announced. I would keep my eyes on that race. That's the sleeper race that people aren't talking about. And Daniel Cameron is the future of the Republican Party.
He's a really impressive guy.
He's so impressive.
He really is. And I think if there's one thing, one silver lining from COVID, it's that parents kind of got a peek behind the curtain. You're teaching my kid what? I'm a guy get involved in school board meetings. Next thing you know, you're trying to trans my kid by, wait, what? You're trying to keep secrets with my kid from me? And I think with this Israel conflict, the war that's going on right now, one of the first byproducts we've seen in this country is people are looking around going, wait a minute. First, you're teaching my grade school kids this. Now I find out what you're teaching young men and women in college about, like, and I heard a conservative had told me recently, he said, I can't believe they started doing this in colleges. And I was like, started? Where do you think the teachers learned it? They learned it in school too. This has been going on for decades.
That's exactly right.
Yes. This has been happening for a long time in this country. So you're waking up to what everyone else has kind of seen or we've been hearing about or there have been rumors about. And now we kind of see it full force. And you hit a topic I really do want to, I want to go down this road for just a minute if I can, because the abortion topic is one that is not going away. We'll have this conversation in the presidential debate. We already have. We'll have it in future ones too. I do think Republicans, look, I'm pro-life. I'm just going to say that. But I do think Republicans, when we won that Dobbs ruling, it was kind of like the dog that caught the car. We just went silent for 3 months. And so the left called us all these horrible names and they ran on it and they pigeonholed us in all these ways. There was a bill before the Senate that every Democrat but one voted for that allowed for abortion anytime, anywhere, for any reason, up until the moment of birth, and they wanted you to pay for it with your tax dollars. 86% of the people in this country reject that position. 86% do not like where the Democrats are. I think Republicans have a chance here to talk about this in the right way, to talk about the life of the woman and the baby and protecting them both. But figuring out a way to say, look, can't we all agree at least up until this point we can come to some consensus? And I'm asking you this because of Mississippi, because of Kentucky, states like that that have made movement on abortion. Do you think there's a way to kind of go on offense here and make the Democrats answer for their position, which is abhorrent to a vast majority of the American people, and talk about our position in a way that doesn't turn people off.
You have to figure a way to go around the media on that, because they'll never play it.
You
talk about it, but I think whatever the position, because there are some Republicans are not, you know, staunchly pro-life.
Sure.
You state what your position is. You believe that it was right for it to go back to the states. It was not a federal issue. And the states decide. And whatever that state decides, you will uphold the law. And I think you keep it that simple.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's what we had, the argument always was about Roe v. Wade, that it should be a state decision. And now that it is a state decision.
Tried to bring it back to the feds. And I'm like, why are you doing that?
I disagree with the timing of that, but I will say the left is not going to let it go because they want to reinstitute it. So if they're not, and you want to have the fight, we're going to have to figure out how to fight it in a way that makes more sense, I guess.
Well, I was talking to a pretty good Democratic strategist the other day, because look, we're going to win on abortion for this cycle, maybe next cycle, but then it's going to not, we're not, it's just not, we can't run on it forever. There's just not enough bandwidth to run on just that. Eventually, we have to actually be for something.
I have to add in here that it pains me that Republicans and Democrats both just use abortion as a policy to run on. They just both completely dehumanize the act of what is happening. And I understand this is just my personal opinion. I'm sure the political people won't quite agree so much, but to me, there are some things worth losing elections for, and standing for life from the moment of conception is that for me. But I will say, as Republicans, we need to do a much better job of messaging it and communicating it, not letting the left win that war. That's just my probably unpopular opinion.
It's not unpopular. It's just that, you know, look, whether it's McCarthy or Jim Jordan or Speaker Johnson now, there's still political reality exists. We don't control the Senate and we don't control the White House. So how do you get as much conservatism done and touted as possible without giving away the store? I'm where you are, Sonny, on the policy, and I'm where you are on from a religious aspect, from a scientific aspect. But the reality is most of Americans, of the American people, aren't. So how do we get as much as we can? Remember, a lot of these movements, you know, they don't start out, you know, regardless how you feel about LGBT, they didn't start out with gay marriage. It started with just, we're here, we're queer, get used to it. Then it was like civil unions. Then they got to marriage. Like, it was a movement that took a long time. It seems like the left, Selena, does a better job playing the long game than we do in a lot of ways. Is that accurate? Well,
that's true. However, Republicans did get a big victory for having overturned Roe. And that happened because you have a conservative or president. And look, Trump and McConnell, they may not love each other. They probably don't even like each other. However, that fusion between the two of them is what gave you the court that we have for a generation.
Yeah. Speaking of courts, just real quick, in Pennsylvania, it's so important, these local races. You just hit on them, and you've been traveling around, so you understand this. If I'm not mistaken, I spoke in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania recently, and that Supreme Court judge candidate was there, one of them, the Republican. And she made a comment that said something like, if in fact she doesn't win and the Republicans don't take back the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania, the next opportunity doesn't come around for like two decades. Is that right?
2035.
Gee.
Look, the Republicans dropped the ball in 2015. Absolutely, without any doubt. They put zero. The Democrats put a ton of money in it, and they won three of those state Supreme Court races. And as a result of that, the Democrat-controlled state Supreme Court took congressional seats and just turned them upside down in the middle of a year, and just redrew every line. They also changed our voting in my state several times. The voting some of the sort of requirements during COVID, and so I think that while if Carlucci wins, she will not make it a Republican majority. However, she will at least help balance that court out, which is now 4-2. One of the state Supreme Court. It's 5-2. She would at least bring it up to a more balanced court. And I think also in Allegheny County, that's the county that surrounds Pittsburgh. Not only do we have a former member of the DSA running to run the county, we also have a DA candidate who is not a little bit, not just a little bit funded by George Soros, all funded by George Soros. It's the only money he has gotten. And I think that Soros has, whatever you feel, how you feel about him, he's been brilliant in going after these really local races. And now 20% of the country has public defenders that have been backed by Soros. Americans should be like, wait, what?
Well, you know what I think is funny is it's when you talk about this kind of stuff on social media about what the Soros plan has been, the left gets really defensive about it, and they accuse you of being, for one thing, anti-Semitic by daring to criticize
him.
You can't criticize the guy at all. but then they say, what are you talking about? There's no evidence of this. And I always think it's so crazy. You know how we know what George Soros has been up to this whole time? He wrote an op-ed outlining what his plan is.
Yeah.
He told us what he's going to do.
He didn't pretend. And we see the implications of this. You saw the in Chicago. I mean, she's actually not running. She was so terrible. Even the Democrats threw her out. And you saw it in Philadelphia. You've seen it in Manhattan. You've seen it in LA. So there was one in California that was recalled. I can't remember what his name was. But there have been real time.
Gascon.
There's one in at Denver, at Tampa. And so, you know, he's been brilliant, and Republicans haven't had an answer to that. They used to be very, very good at winning local races, state house and state senate. But the post-Trump years, after Trump won in 2018 and 2020 and 2022, those all fell apart.
Yeah, the Soros funded DA candidates and then the ones who win, to me, that's a bigger problem than just, who's wearing what political jersey and they're winning races that we used to win or that we should win. This is because what he's doing is he's electing prosecutors who are aggressively pursuing very damaging policies. I mean, these election victories result in district attorneys who are terrible for those communities. It's really a disaster. That's the problem with all of this. So I know that we said we're going to be respectful of your time, Celino, and we're running a little bit late, and I apologize for that. And I just want to thank you again. I know how busy you are, your lengthy resume and the legion of people who are expecting to read your words every single week in various publications. So thank
you. Every day, they can go to selinazito.com. Sign up for my emails. They're free. They're fun. They're not fattening. you all over the country. You never know what I'm going to be writing about. I could be down inside a coal mine, 1,600 feet down inside a coal mine, or I could be interviewing Ron DeSantis at his hometown in Florida.
I know where you won't be on a plane.
That's right.
No. What do you have? You ever learned anything good on an airplane? No. Nothing is ever interesting.
That's true. I hate flying.
Anyway, thank you very much. The great Celina Zito, a fantastic guest. And for Hogan Gidley and Sonny Joy Nelson, I'm Tim Murtaugh. This has been the Line Drive Podcast.